Because there are, there are things which this audience knows backwards, namely that what spin foams are and so on, blah blah. And the main point being that you got this action in the continuum at any rate, and you discretize it. And the action contains this gamma business and this, which can be replaced with an angle. Okay? And the area tensors, come on, don't you be sarcastic. Nothing to laugh about, okay? And the area tensors are constrained to be simple, namely to be originate from triangles and to sum to zero, because they should be part of a close polyhedron, which it happens to be tetrahedron in the specific case. Is it a successful theory? Well, there's lots of word about it. They have very brilliant ideas. And I think the really brilliant idea is that of imposing the constraints through the Gupta Bloy on the states. But to make the theory practical, which means competitive in the market, and you need a little bit more, see? There are difficulties, the ones which I'm interested in and I will focus about. One is the fact that in the asymptotic limit, which has been worked out by John Barrett, what you get is the cosine of the Regge thing, see, the area times angle. While what you want is the exponential of the area. And this, I think, is serious because I've looked at the analysis done by Oriti and Levine years ago before that, and it looks as though this really spoils causality. You don't think so, but I think it does. It gives you the wrong propagator without the I epsilon, which is what you want. And the other difficulty is that all the work is done with space-like tetrahedra, with some remarkable exception, by Conradi and Nibida. I'm sorry that I didn't have the space to put his name in, because he's the fellow who's going to speak immediately after me. However, the point is that getting a triangulations with only space-like tetrahedra is very difficult. In practice, not really likely. You take a triangulation and you look at it in ordinary space-time, and you look at it, it's not really made up of space-like tetrahedra. You've got the time-like as well. Doesn't work. Okay. I've tested it and it doesn't work, okay? Now, the point is that time-like tetrahedra, hang on a second. Time-like tetrahedra are tricky, as pointed out by Conradi and Nibida a few years ago.
There's very, very few of them.
Yeah, the competition. The competition, from this point of view, you see, is given by causal dynamical triangulations, which it's much easier to set about, whereupon they do fantastic simulations with thousands of tetrahedra and so on, but I'm not particularly happy about it, because all their tetrahedra are time-like, okay? And this spoils Courant criterion, which may or may not apply, but I think it does. I beg your pardon?
What is Courant?
Hang on a second, I'll show you. That's it, see. Now, this picture, pathetically, tries to show you what Courant criteria is. Namely, if you are in the business of solving partial differential equations of the hyperbolic type, see, you don't want, the step cannot be very long, otherwise, of course, you don't have enough data. See, that's the Courant criteria. Namely, if this is if the jagged thing is the light cone, you want to stay below it. If you go above it, of course, you should really have a larger surface at the bottom, okay, which you do not have. And this is the typical picture which comes in causal dynamical triangulation. While in spin foam, you have this squashed down thing, you see, which, of course. But even if you squash it down, and this picture is pathetic because it doesn't show the squashed. You still, when you do one four simplex like this, and it looks all right, but then you, in its neighbor has to be, namely has to have 3-2, okay, on the next space-like hypersurface, And you look at it, it doesn't, and it's very difficult to make it, to make it space-like, to make it made of space-like things. You see, I can show you the details.
Even the full triangulation is L such that it is squeezed by L, and it's space-like.
No. Not with the 3-2. Not with this. No. Hang on. It works with this, all right? But it does not work with this. That is a surprising thing. You know, you can actually do it with, you can do it explicitly, and I have done it explicitly. And there's a very limited range of values for L prime in which it does. But of course, you cannot really constrain L prime. I mean, you know, who are you to constrain L prime? L prime should be, you know, like L in principle.
Sorry.
Now, on a classical.
Is what you're saying true in 2 plus 1, 2, or it applies only to 3 plus 1?
I've only done it 3 plus 1. Okay. I don't know anything about 2 plus.
Okay, so it's really about the 3-2 move, you say?
Yes.
That I'm trying to understand what is the exact statement about the 3-2 move you want to say? Because here it's drawn in 3D, so it's kind of hard.
Yes, of course. But I mean, what you do is, you assume that, of course, the initial lengths are all equal, okay, L, okay, of the you got the tetrahedron to start with, okay? Then you go to the next point, which is adds one point and makes it into a full simplex, okay? And now you want, this is the 4-1 configuration. But then you also have the 3-2 configuration, which is this one, okay? Now, if for this one you assume that all the initial lengths are the same and all the diagonal lengths are space-like and equal, then you only got L prime free in principle, but not really. And you would like it to be made of space-like tetrahedra. And what you find is that it is not. Which is unfortunate, but what can I do? You bash it down. And you bash it until it does what you want. It doesn't. It doesn't cooperate. I'll show you the calculation. I beg your pardon?
It doesn't if you keep L prime fixed.
Well, no, I leave L prime free to do what he wants. There's a paper by a fellow called Bruin. He's an Australian guy, you see, who tells you how to calculate. To do the classical Reggie calculations, okay? So you use it, and you can actually stick it in the. If you're clever, you can use Mathematica, and it does everything for you, okay? So I've used it, not using Mathematica because I'm not clever, and I can see that it doesn't work. I mean, it's unfortunate, but okay.
What is it that does not exist?
Namely, that if you take this type of configuration, the range of L prime for which all tetrahedra are space-like is extremely limited.
Well,
you cannot have, for example, L prime equal L.
Why do you want L prime equal L?
Well, I don't want it a priori, but I would like L prime to be free, to assume whichever value it pleases. It's not. We shall argue it afterwards, okay? Anyway, notation, forget it. No, because, I've got 5 minutes left, all right? So simplicity means that the various triangles which form the tetrahedron must be simple, therefore made of. Having area tensors which are anti-symmetric products of two four vectors. The other the clever way of expressing it is to say that there is a vector, a four vector, which is orthogonal to all the surfaces, okay, which you call V. That's going to be a role in the future. And if you express it in that terms, this is the form of the simplicity. This is the form of the simplicity constraint that you get, if I can get the right point. Yeah, that's it, okay? In the two limit cases, this is what you get. This is the familiar one. This is the unfamiliar one. And the question is, can you forget the difference and treat them all the same way? Which is what I would like. Okay? Because if you don't forget the difference, but you have all sorts of tetrahedra, that means that given the triangulations, you have to go tetrahedra by tetrahedra and saying, you are time-like, oh, you know, you are space-like, and so on, which is ridiculous. Okay? Now, given that, oh, then there is now some identity which gives you this nice form of S star, which means blah, blah, okay. You introduce spinners following this lot of folks to spinners for each triangle, then they transform in a certain way. Of course, you could lump them into a Dirac spinner, but that's unfashionable, so you call it a twister, which is much better, okay? you don't really use the twister properties in great depth at this level, okay? I mean, to be more accurate, I don't know how to use the profound properties of twister analysis, okay? I would like to, of course. One day I shall make it. And you again express the simplicity constraints. Now there is a smart identity, which is this one, which was in the previous slide on the notation. And this allows you to write them in a very simple form and to actually solve them in making a relation between T and U, the two spinners which characterize the phrase, which is what Simone previously called the incidence relation. I knew it as, what the hell? Where the hell is the point? I keep missing it. Ah, here it is, okay. Which is what Simone previously called the incidence relation. It's pretty much the same, you see? But there is this KT, of which I cannot get rid of, because you would like to absorb it into U, and you can't, as I'll show in a second. This is, of course, Penrose's equation. And this constraint, you see, these constraints were second class. And this one are not, this because they only contain the holomorphic part. You see, so they do not Poisson commute with the complex conjugate. So this is rather smart. As a consequence, 3 minutes. As a consequence, you get the equations which were in the paper by Dupuy, Levin, Speziale, oh, the one Fred Elias, sure. These are there, but you see they change because now I've got this case, which, as I mentioned before, I cannot get rid of. Okay, why can't I get rid of them? Because I have allowed the possibility of time-like tetrahedra. Okay, and indeed, when you make it explicit, you find that for time-like tetrahedra, the K cannot have all the same signs. So that creates a problem which I don't know how to solve, namely, how the hell do you attribute the signs to this K? Okay? But I mean, I think that can be done by cleverly using the orientation property of your triangulation. That doesn't mean that I've done it. Eh? This is all very nice and takes care of J, but from the point of view of quantization, it's completely useless because unless you carry on, as Simone mentioned before, and you quantize straight. However, that's not what is usually done. What is usually done is to use APRL, which means before them, Barrett and Crane. Sorry. Jeffy, I've got 1 minute. Give me the minute. namely, to use the constraints to limit the representations of SL2C on which you sum. And the typical case is the one which Laurent doesn't seem to like very much, in which you use the diagonal part to constrain the representations you can use. And what you get is that given that a representation of SL2C has got two parameters, n and rho, you get that either rho is n gamma or minus n over gamma. Spinners and all the previous lovely things don't add anything to this picture. Now, what that's unfortunate, you see, because all this is well known to all the experts, namely the fact that for space like tetrahedra, you get as a result that rho is equal to gamma j and n is equal to 2j, namely that you can limit the, you can use the canonical basis for the SL2C representation in terms of SU2 representations, and you get a simple relations between the j of the SU2 representation and rho. Okay? In the case of SU11, namely for time-like tetrahedra, you're not quite as lucky. And it turns out that either for the discrete spectra, SU11 is a mess of a group, much studied by the real amateurs of the subject, okay, which begins with Sherin and Toller when I was a student, some time ago. Okay? But in that case, you get that for space, for the discrete spectrum, you get a rho is equal to gamma j. And for the continuous spectrum, you get a rho has to be minus n over gamma, and that's a real mess. Okay? So that doesn't seem to be a viable way of carrying on. So what can you do? Well, yes, you can constrain it. Forget it. Namely, you can construct the vertex amplitude, you can constrain the amplitude for the phase, you give it the John Barrett, he makes an asymptotic expansion, and turns out to be very much like the red reaction, but that only applies, as I said, in the case, and in the limit n gamma, it gives you the cosine of, instead of the exponential. So there's no causality built in the model, according to Levine and Oriti. So it must be changed somehow. How the hell do you change it? I don't know. there are alternatives. Well, one alternative is to carry on the program as indicated by Simone, namely do the quantization directly without taking any notice of Engler, Pereira, Levine, and Rovelli, and deriving that thing. See, but I wasn't able to do it. The other possibility is to say, no, OK, forget about using states of definite areas, because that is the point. If you forget about using states of definite area, then you have you can use eigenstates of L3 and K3. I'm always shooting, but not much, which is an abelian subgroup. Of course, it's very difficult. The idea of abandoning the area quantization is a bit unpleasant. Has been done. I have to shut down. I have to shut up.
To jump to
conclusion. Yeah.
The conclusion is that we have to think all the sessions. Therefore.
No. Hang on a second. I mean, the conclusion of the next slide. So I mean, what the hell, right? So what I wanted to say is that, well, all right, you can. The trick which I suggest is to use, instead of using canonical basis of the SU11 basis, is to use a base of light-like vectors like this PI, which I think has got very nice and interesting properties, which I should not tell you about. So what you do, you have to use spinners which are eigenstates of L3 and K3. You construct the basis, then you have to carry on your work and work out coherent states, which will be minimum uncertainty states, because now you have a continuum spectrum. K3 and L3 are related, have to be multiple of each other, and that will be done sometime. The mermaid is because ends in a fish, okay? Designating fish, like all my talks. That's all. I'm sorry.
So let's just have one question, maybe.
I should bash it out with Carlo later on.
Okay, and so maybe let's thank Giorgio and.
Thank you very much. Now, this is nothing to do with it.
Interesting,
isn't it? It comes from Burma. and horrors of people that neglect causality. I was forgetting to give you this.
Ah, thanks.
Hang on a sec. Stick it in your pocket.
Okay.
And stick this somewhere on your shirt. And so, oh, sorry for the shooting.
That's okay. I'll talk fast.
It's
on. How do I change? Okay.
And you can point.
Excellent. All right. All right. Thanks. So I'm going to talk about a quantum model of twisted geometry, something that I worked on with Laurent over the last little while. And this arose from the study of a new basis of intertwiners, SU2 intertwiners, in the holomorphic representation. And then the whole twisted geometry thing just kind of popped out in the end. And in hindsight, this isn't very surprising because we were working with spinners, but I think it's still pretty remarkable. So here is just a list of work done by people reformulating loop quantum gravity in terms of spinners and twisters in the last little while. And these are some of the key results that relate directly to what I'm going to talk about. But in the interest of time, I'll just move on. So the plan is I'll be able to, so I'll discuss the holomorphic representation of SU2. In that representation, there's a natural notion of intertwiners. I'll take these intertwiners, I'll contract them together into a new amplitude, depending on 20 spins, which we'll call a 20J symbol. We'll look at the asymptotics, and out of the asymptotics will come a twisted geometry, and I'll be able to give a classical action for twisted geometry. So let's begin. So the holomorphic representation, so here's the notation for spinners. So it's a pair of complex numbers. And if we have holomorphic functions of the spinners, there's this Bargmann-Fock inner product, which has a Gaussian measure. Okay, and in this space, we have an orthonormal basis, which is just the usual JM basis that you're used to in SU2. And if you restrict to just the J states, then this is the usual representation space of spin J. Okay, so that's what I just said. If you take the span of the JM states, you get a spin J space. And an intertwiner is nothing more than just an invariant tensor. So we take a tensor product of these spaces, and we look at the SU2 invariant elements, okay, and they form a subspace. And so here I've drawn just an example of a five-valent intertwiner. So the intertwiner is on the node, and they carry spins on the legs, okay? And then you can glue these things together into spin networks by joining them along the edges. So in this representation, there's a very natural basis of intertwiners. So suppose we have n spinners. Okay, we need to construct a holomorphic function of the spinners, which is invariant under SU2. So it turns out that there's only there are n choose 2 holomorphic invariants of the spinners given by the following form right there. So a natural thing to do would be to just look at the monomials of these invariants for some natural number powers. Okay, so we have. And then to be in this representation space, we just need to restrict the homogeneity of the spinners of these monomials. So if you sum over all of the k's of a certain spinner, it should sum up to 2ji. And that will put it in the representation space of spin ji. Okay? So let's look at an example. So in the three-valent case, we know it's a one-dimensional space. So we have these three conditions, and they have a unique solution in terms of the j's. Okay, so we have three k's, three j's, unique solution, and as you'd expect, this single state is proportional to the Wigner 3j symbol, as it has to be because, you know, this space is trivial. And then I'll just mention that the usual way of going to a four-valent basis is to take two of these three-valent intertwiners and then just glue them together along one edge. Okay? And there's three ways to do this. corresponding to the three Mandelstam channels, right? S, T, and U. And so this shows that the usual orthonormal basis is labeled by one extra spin. OK, so let's look at the four-valent case in this new basis. So in this new basis, we'll have four conditions and six k's. OK, so we're going to have to parameterize these k's. And we're going to have two extra parameters. So a convenient parameterization is inspired by this STU decomposition. And the S and T and U satisfy one condition. That is, they sum up to the sum of all the spins, J1 through J4. So this means that we can parameterize the k's in terms of the four spins, ji, plus two extra parameters, s and t. And so this is now a new basis. But I just said that the orthonormal basis is labeled by one extra spin. And here we have a basis labeled by two extra spins. This means we're going to have more states than the dimension of the space. So that means the space is overcomplete. Now, this might frighten some people, but it turns out that this isn't an obstacle. And owing to the power of Gaussian integration in these things, all the calculations that we needed to do turn out to be tractable. And for example, you can prove that the resolution of identity on the space takes a very simple form. OK, so what is the relation between these states and the orthonormal basis? Well, it's very simple. If we just take a sum over t of these st states, we get the s channel back. So here I've given like a graphical representation of this. So we sum over t, and this expands the four-valent node into a s channel, and similarly for the t and the u. Now we can use these theorems to prove some nice results. So for example, let's construct an amplitude out of these states. Okay, so we'll take five of the st states, and we just contract them into a four simplex. Okay, so this will be an amplitude which depends on 20 spins, the 10 j's on the edges, plus an s and a t on each node. So we call it a 20j symbol. Now, because of these summation relations, I can just sum over t at each of these nodes, and it'll expand the node out into a s channel. And that's precisely a 15j symbol. So this shows that the 20j symbol is more fundamental. You can generate, and not only can you generate the 15j symbol with all s channels, by summing over different combinations of s's and t's, you can get all of the different kinds of 15j symbols. There's five kinds in total. OK, so now let's do the reverse. So I just showed how you can write the 15j in terms of the 20. Let's write the 20 in terms of the 15. So I can do that by inserting a resolution of identity on the orthonormal basis that looks like this at each node. OK, so you can imagine at each node, I'm going to get an overlap between the ST state and, say, the S state. So that's this term here. And then the resulting graph on the inside will be a 15J symbol. So that's this formula here. So now I use the resummation or summation theorem again. And I can sum over a superfluous T here to make this a little bit more symmetric. And then it's not hard to show that the overlap in the ST state in the uniformly large spin limit is orthogonal. Okay, so that means the 20j symbol in the uniformly large spin limit, it'll kill all of these sums. And it's proportional to the 15j. And the proportionality constant are some familiar constants. So that means if we can find the asymptotics of the 20j symbol, that will give us the asymptotics of the 15j symbol. So this is kind of for the first time. Like, so the asymptotics that was done by Friedel and Conradi and the Nottingham group was in terms of the coherent 15J symbol, so the amplitude you get from contracting the coherent intertwiners. But this sort of unravels that, and you get the asymptotics of the bona fide 15J symbol for the first time. So let me show you how to do this. You can easily write this amplitude in terms of an integral, okay? And you have e to some action, and this action is just, so this comes from the Gaussian measure, and this is just the monomials exponentiated, okay? And this is just a real integral, we can find the stationary points. You do that, and you find that the stationary points are described by oriented frame tetrahedra. What this means is they are solutions satisfying the closure relation, the spinorial version of the closure relation, but they also have a U1 symmetry for each phase. This corresponds to changing the phase of the spinners. And then there's also a Z2 symmetry corresponding to changing the spinners to their conjugate, which is like inverting the tetrahedron. So what is the geometrical interpretation of this? Well, if we use the Penrose null flag interpretation of the spinner, so the spinners define a normal vector, areas, and a frame vector. So these are unit vectors which are orthogonal. So it's a flagpole and a flag. Then we can define the edge vectors of the tetrahedron by the cross products of the normals. And let me define theta to be the 3D dihedral angles, so the angles between the normal vectors. And I'll define alpha to be the angle between the frame vectors and the edges. Okay? So these will be all the geometrical data. Then these U1 gauge symmetries that I mentioned, the changing of the phase of the spinner, corresponds to a rescaling of the alphas. Okay? So what we should do is we should try and write the action in terms of gauge invariant variables, right? Well, there are two such variables. Here they are. And this alpha here corresponds to the angle between edge vector bj and bk in the tetrahedron A. Yes? Oh, fine. And similarly, OK. And then so here I've drawn a little picture of two tetrahedron being glued together along a face. So you find that the angles in the two tetrahedra of two glued triangles are not equal. So the angles, when viewed from separate tetrahedra, are not the same. This means that the shapes of the triangles that are matched are not equal. They're not the same. This is the twisted part of the twisted geometry. So the areas are the same, but the shapes are not. But we find that if you impose a shape matching condition, so you just put that into here, you find that the second gauge invariant variable becomes independent of its lower index. So I'll show you that, or I'll state that these xi's will correspond to 40 dihedral angles in the 4 simplex, but only when shape matching is enforced. And this is something that Bianca and Jimmy worked out a long time ago. So now let me show you what the action looks like in terms of the gauge invariant variables. So this is what it looks like. So we have a term which looks very much like the Regge action. And then we have another term which turns out to be a canonical phase. So when I introduced the states, I didn't give a phase convention. But it turns out that in the asymptotics, you get one imposed. And this was something that was mentioned in the Nottingham paper. This xi here is not a 4D dihedral angle. It's a generalization to twisted geometry. Okay, it's this thing. It's the average of those three xi variables that I mentioned before. And when you impose a shape matching condition, then these three become independent of their lower index, and it just becomes one. And you can show that it does indeed satisfy the relations of a 4D dihedral angle with respect to 3D and 2D. Okay, so here's a summary. Hopefully I've convinced you that that using these spinner variables is a very powerful and simple way of doing recoupling theory. Powerful mostly because of the Gaussian integration. We introduced a new basis of intertwiners. It was discrete, labeled by a discrete set of spins, as opposed to the coherent intertwiners, which are labeled by spinners. So it's a continuous set of data. But regardless, they're coherent in the sense that they're peaked on, you know, unique up to gauge transformations, frame tetrahedra. And they provide a bridge between the coherent and orthonormal bases. I think they're very closely related to the U intertwiners. And you know, in the end, having all of these representations will be really important in the future. We defined a new 20J symbol, which seems to be more fundamental than the 15J. and gave us the asymptotics of the 15J symbol for free. And the asymptotics gave us a nice twisted geometry interpretation. Thank you.
Maybe you want to questions for Josh?
Yeah.
Your generalized Regi action, and does it somehow, I mean, relates to Einstein gravity? I mean, so can you somehow, some seem to me it's kind of Regi action in terms of twisted geometry, right? As you said, and I mean, does it somehow relates to, relates to some discretization of Einstein gravity with twisted variable, or do you have some comment on that?
So it's like you have twisted, and then you have Einstein gravity, and then you have Regi in between. So you can go from twisted to Regi, and then to Einstein, like that.
But I mean, can you say the continuum limit of your generalized Regi action still give Einstein gravity, or some relation with that? Somehow, so if you suppose you have many, I mean, your computation only for one simplex, but suppose you have several simplex, that's your twisted geometry. Generalized Regi calculus also still relates to Einstein gravity in the continuum limit, in some sense.
I don't know. Yeah, we were just considering 1-4 simplex.
Well, but at least 1-4 simplex should give the boundary term. It should give the extrinsic power.
I'm sorry, I just don't understand.
It is, however, a Lorentzian 4 simplex.
No, this was Euclidean. Euclidean. Yeah, it's a Euclidean spherical four simplex.
Yeah, but still, it's postponed to discretization of boundary term of
Yeah.
So, I just asked, because it's an open question for how to discretize Einstein gravity using twisted geometry. I mean, one knows how to discretize it using Regi calculus.
Right.
But, it seems to me you write down some analog.
That's right. Yeah, so I think that has to be something that has to be worked out. So we started with just like a quantum amplitude, and we computed, and this was just the action we got. But you're right, that's something that needs to be looked at.
Just have a very, very quick question. I was wondering did you check if this psi that you defined is invariant under the gauge transformations generated by the area matching condition? This is a question I had and I couldn't find it in the paper.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, but we should talk about that. Yeah.
Okay, so let's thank Jeff.
Yes.
So it's on. Everything's fine. That's the point where you can flip slides.
Okay.
Okay, so now we have Wolfgang Behrendt from Marseille about Hamiltonian spin and spin form.
Thank you, Valentin, and thank you for inviting, for allowing me to speak about my PhD thesis that I did in Marseille. So spin-form gravity is a proposal to give transition amplitudes for loop quantum gravity. So it's a candidate theory for quantum gravity, let's say. And to see whether it is makes mathematical sense and physically sense, we can go, we can study two things. First, we can start from the quantum theory and try to define the semi-classical limit and see whether it gives GR. But we can also do the opposite, and this is what I'm talking about here. So one can try to start from a classical theory, which is a certain truncation of general relativity, canonically quantize and see whether one gets spin from amplitudes or something else. So the outline of the talk is, in the first part, I speak about the continuum action for spin from gravity. Then I'm studying the equations of motion derived from this action. And then I will comment, if there is hopefully enough time, also about the quantum theory. So how to define an inner product, and what are the transition amplitudes. And within the reduced setting of a fixed discretization of space-time, I can show that spin from gravity comes from a classical theory, which is a version of first-order Recce calculus, where spinors that have appeared in all the two previous talks play a fundamental role. So let us go to the first part. So how to derive a continuum action. So spin from gravity starts from a topological action, which is just BF. And if I write this in self-dual variables, it is a functional of the SL2C Lie algebra value 2 from sigma AB. So AB are spinor indices, and the curvature, the connection 1 form, and the integrand is just the Lorentz invariant contraction of the curvature 2 form with the Blavatsky 2 form, and in front of the this integrand appears a complex valued coupling constant, which is parameterized by the immersive parameter. And since we want the action to be real, there is also the complex conjugate representation appearing. So this is not GR, of course, but to get to GR, we need some constraints that guarantee that sigma AB is geometrical, that is, defines a metric, comes from a metric geometry. In fact, sigma AB, so this SL2C Lie algebra value 2 form, should be the self-dual part of E over G. So now we discretize, so we start from a four-dimensional discretization, and on the spatial slices this induces triangulation, and now we can smear our elementary phase space variables over these lower dimensional structures. So the flux is, so the momentum variable is smeared over the triangles in the frame of one of the two adjacent tetrahedra, while the configuration variable, so the connection, is smeared over link dual to the triangles. And now the continuum Poisson brackets, the continuum Poisson structure induces commutation relations among those, and this is just T star of SL2C. Now, T star of SL2C is a nonlinear phase space with no Dabur coordinates, but spinors are a useful tool to deal with this nonlinearity. So, if we take the flux in, say, the initial point, we can always find a pair of diagonalizing spinors, but these spinors live in the frame of the initial tetrahedron. And if we now take the holonomy, we can map them to the final point and get another pair of spinors. And now we can just view the spinors as the elementary configuration variables and parameterize both holonomy and flux. So this is only possible if there is a constraint fulfilled, which just says that the area of the triangle should be the same in whatever frame, from whatever frame we look at it. And if we now introduce the natural symplectic structure, which just tells us that the pi spinor is the momentum conjugate of the omega spinor, and we perform symplectic reduction with respect to this constraint, we get back to the original phase space. So this is all very nice, but it does not tell us anything about the dynamics. So to study the dynamics, we have to go back to a four-dimensional picture and study simplicial decomposition of space-time. So this consists of four simplices glued among bounding tetrahedra. And each four simplex consists of 10 triangles, and each triangle has also a dual. So it's not only important to think of the of this picture, but also about it in terms of the dual picture. And the dual of a triangle is what we call a spin form face. So it, a spin form face touches all four simplices this triangle belongs to. And the part, so this is just about nomenclatura, so the part of a spin form face that belongs to a given four simplex is a wedge. And now we discretize the action on this lower dimensional structure, so the topological action, and we get just one contribution from each wedge. Now this is a discretized action, and when we have a discretized action, it's not so easy to study what are the equations of motion, what are the evolution equations, what is the constraint algebra. And so therefore it's useful to make a step back into the continuum. And how do we do this? So I introduce on each wedge n additional auxiliary wedges and dress these auxiliary wedges with the with these spinorial variables. And if I now take a limit where I introduce infinitely many of these wedges, I get the continuum action for this for each wedge. And what is this action? It is for the topological, if I start from the topological theory, discretize, then introduce this continuum limit, then I get to this action. So this action is a functional of spinors that now live as a continuum field all along the boundary of this wedge. But it also depends on the connection. In fact, the connection, the original SL2C connection, contracted with the tangent vector of the edge. And this appears here in this covariant derivative, which is just the covariant time derivative in the direction of this edge. So this is this the topological action in terms of this this continuum limit. So this is just one contribution. To get the complete the action, we have to sum over all wedges that appear in the discretization. But that is just the topological theory. To get gravity, we have to add constraints. And here I'm looking only at the linear constraints that guarantee that each of these fluxes define planes in Minkowski space. That is, that they are normal to the that they are orthogonal to the normal of the tetrahedron the triangle actually belongs to. And then I get these constraints written in terms of spinors. And now I can add them to the action. And I just do this by additional Lagrange multipliers. And now I get the constrained action. So what are the equations of motion derived from this action? Well, for this, I have to collect the contributions that belong to a tetrahedron. Why? Well, because in this d over dt, so in this d over dt, there appears the connection contracted with the tangent vector of the edge. But this expression, so this d over dt, appears in all four triangles that belong to the same tetrahedron. So therefore, I collect all the contributions coming from a tetrahedron, and I get this action. So this is a sum over all four triangles appearing in this tetrahedron. And now I can look at the equations of motion. So I just vary everything this action depends on. If I vary the connection contracted with the tangent vector of the edge, I get the Gauss law. If I vary lambda and z, I get the simplicity constraints. And the evolution equations with respect to this time variable on the edge, I get from the variation of omega and pi.
So all these variables are independent from variables that appear in other edges?
Yes. And now, so what about the evolution equations? So they tell us that the covariant time derivative of the spinors is generated by a Hamiltonian, which is just a sum over of constraints. But now we have to check whether this Hamiltonian preserves the constraints themselves. And what we find is that the first class constraints are only preserved if the Lagrange multiplier in front of them vanishes. And this gives me the secondary Hamiltonian. So this is just about the time evolution along an edge. But the spin foam phase is something that is closed. So I have to specify boundary conditions in order to know how to glue these things together. And if I choose all spinors to be continuous, I run into a problem. And this problem is the flatness problem that has appeared already today in a talk. So one possibility to solve this is to relax these boundary conditions. And in fact, to allow for discontinuities in the spinors, but only gentle discontinuities. That means, that is to say, that so the spinors are I've introduced to parameterize fluxes. So I can use I can allow for discontinuities in the spinors while not having any discontinuities in the fluxes, and this is guaranteed by this. This is done by this weakened boundary conditions. And so, what do we get then? So why should we think this is discretized gravity? Well, there are two indications, but of course no proof. So the first indication is what we know already from Barrett, that once we solve the equations of motion, we can assign a unique metrical geometry to the simplicial decomposition. That is, we can give to each bone bounding a triangle that appears in the in this simplicial decomposition a unique edge length. And the second indication, which is more important, or which is equally important, is that there's curvature in the model. That from in this analysis, it follows simply because the spinors are not parallel along the edge. And if I, with the boundary conditions that I have introduced previously, I can now calculate the holonomy around the spin foam phase. And with these boundary conditions, it turns out to be a poor boost, a poor, pure boost. So exactly what we want in, to have in Recce gravity. So these are the two indications. So now this is all classical, and one could ask how to quantize the theory. But that turns out to be now not so difficult, simply because I have a phase space, a Hamiltonian, and everything is, and some constraints. So it doesn't look so difficult anymore. So I start with an auxiliary phase space, which is just used to define all the constraints and give the proper arena to impose the constraints. And that is just the space of square integral functions on C2. Now on this space, in this space, there is the canonical basis many of us are familiar with. So it diagonalizes the Casimirs of SL2C together with the indices JM match the SU2 subgroup. And these are not integrable in this basis, so they're in this space, so they are a generalized basis. And now we can look at the simplicity constraints and the first class constraint. So it's just diagonal, while the second class constraint acts as like step operators. So the first class constraint, being first class, we can impose it strongly and end up with this solution space. So these are I mentioned that these are distributions, so they are not normalizable in the in this Hilbert space. But if this space can be equipped with a natural inner product, which is just the inner product on the orbits generated by this constraint, so it's just the Hamiltonian vector field contracted with this measure. Well, and now the F constraint is second class, so we just impose half of it, while the so half of it we impose strongly, while the other half maps the solution space to its orthogonal complement. Then the only constraint missing is the Gauss constraint, and imposing all of this gives us just the space of intertwiners expressed in these spinors. So now what about the evolution along an edge? Well, classically, this is now governed by this Hamiltonian equation. But in quantum theory, this can just be quantized, and it's rather simple. So the first term is just an infinitesimal Lorentz generator, while the second term is this constraint. But the constraint itself annihilates any physical state. So we are just left with this term, which matches what Bianchi has recently used as in the, to study the black hole entropy. So what are the transition amplitudes derived from this Schrödinger equation? Well, they are just the elementary building blocks of the EPRL model. So just this simple, so we call them gamma simple states. So the inner product of two of them mapped by the by these bulk holonomies into another frame. And if we glue them together, what we get is the EPRL model on a spin form phase. So within the so the conclusion from this quantum part is that if I use this Hamiltonian formalism on a spin form phase, I get back to the EPRL amplitude on a spin form on this phase. What I cannot derive is the full amplitude, because for this I would need how to I would need to know how to glue all these phases together. But if I do this in the most natural way, I would get the EPRL amplitude. So what is the conclusion? So the conclusion is that the EPRL proposal for the loop gravity transition amplitudes results from the canonical quantization of a classical theory where spinors are the elementary configuration variables. Then I gave two arguments which were purely classical, so without without mentioning the actual quantum theory, why this theory should know something about GR. First, it has curvature, and the second one is that the equations of motion imply geometricity, so that every edge length, every bone bounding a triangle has a unique length. And the third point is that I think this spinorial Hamiltonian formalism is very powerful because it is very general. So it gives a general framework to study spin form models. Thank you.
For Wolfgang.
So you talked about unique edge lengths.
Yes.
Are they unique within every simplex separately, or do the simplices agree on them?
So the simplices agree on them, because so if you in each so why? Because how do I get from one simplex to another? So if I go from one simplex to another, if I go from one simplex to another, I go along an edge. But the evolution equations that I wrote down, these are the evolution equations along an edge, and they do not change the shape of the tetrahedron. They just move it around twist it somehow, and therefore they cannot change the the shape of the tetrahedra, and therefore the edge lengths are the same when going from one tetrahedron to from one four simplex to another four simplex.
Okay, maybe another very short. Is it very short?
So Wolfgang, if I get it right, you have, I mean, beside the full construction, which is very nice, but in particular within it, you have been able to translate entirely sort of the problem that Frank and Wojciech points out into a classical.
Yes.
So it appears already.
In this analysis, it has nothing to do with the
quantization
theory.
Of limits.
It already appears
J,
on the classical level.
And then you have a specific point in the theory where you can allow this the extra phases, extra rotation to take care of it.
Yes.
And then you are saying that you're not sure how this would affect the full quantum theory, and you're suggesting that it would not affect the vertex amplitude or the wedge amplitude.
Exactly.
But it might affect something else. Is that?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Well, let's thank Wolfgang last time. And you need to clip that to your shirt.
So here. And then where is that?
Hold the pointer.
Do
you want to try to steal our pointer?
So
last talk today is by Aleksandar Mikovic from Lusofonia University.
So I will talk about an attempt to generalize spin form models and the idea is to use some higher categorical structures because the spin form models are based on groups, and groups are actual examples of simple examples of category. It's a category with one element, and then the reason why would one want to generalize spin form models? And let me see. We've seen in various talks that there is a problem with the classical limit of spin form models. Actually, this can be most easily seen in the effective action approach, where you basically get the area regi action, and then you know the area regi action is not the same as the length regi action. So you don't get the Einstein equation of motion. Although in this work we conjectured that maybe somehow these non-geometric configurations would be exponentially suppressed dynamically, but it's difficult to show this. So as it is, the effective action simply gives the area regi as the classical limit. Then there is one more obvious problem. That's the problem of coupling with matter, fermionic matter, to spin forms. The point is that spinors couple to the edge lengths, and in spin forms, you know that you cannot always define the metric geometry. You know? So if you just give areas to triangles, then there is which are arbitrary numbers, you cannot, in general, find the edge lengths which would reproduce these areas. So there is no metric geometry, and then if you don't have a metric geometry, you cannot couple spinors. So then you have a problem. So then one then is thinking of how this problem could be resolved. So how would you introduce edge lengths, which are essentially tetrads? So one possibilities to do this, to enlarge the group, so to use the anti-de Sitter or de Sitter BF theory. But it's in the sort of spin form approach does not work because it's you cannot formulate all these nice sort of properties of state sum models. You know, you can try to do perturbation theory, but essentially the problem is there is a constraint which does not, which violates this larger symmetry. And then there is a quadratic in BF constraint, and this does not translate well in the spin form formalism. You can then another possibility is try the so-called Poincaré gauge theory. You know, that's again, it's sort of similar where you sort of treat tetrads as connections, but tetrads do not really transform as connections. So, I mean, it's possible sort of under certain restricted transformations to look at them as connections, but it's not really that. And but there is a way to resolve this problem. Actually, it's really you have to introduce a two group. And that's related. So to okay, so this is a quick sort of resummation of two groups. Okay, basically category is sort of the most general object. Sort of a general structure which mathematicians use. It consists of objects and maps between those objects and certain relations. Then two category, you can then think of objects, maps, and maps between these maps, so-called two morphisms. Again, there are certain relations between them, which sort of they're sort of based on some kind of geometrical intuition. But I'm not going to get into that. And then a group, it can be demonstrated simply category with one object and invertible one morphisms. So a natural thing to define is a two group, which is a two category with one object and invertible one and two morphisms. Now, this abstract definition has a simple realization in terms of usual groups. It's simply a pair of groups. So a two group is something which is called cross module of groups. So you have two groups, and then you have two maps between these two groups, which satisfy certain relations, which are essentially imposed by this categorical structure. So essentially, you can think of it as sort of a pair of groups. So what is important that this G group is the group of one morphisms, and then semi-direct product of this pair is actually a group of two morphisms. And then you see that how the Poincaré group appears, because you have here this semi-direct product, and you know Poincaré group is a semi-direct product, so it's kind of it's a group of two morphisms. So the sort of the simplest example is a so-called Poincaré or Euclidean two group, which is basically G is the Lorentz group or Euclidean, and then you have just these translations as the edge group, and this defines. Now, you can then immediately generalize. So, you know, BF theory is sort of the simplest thing you can, simplest topological theory can construct given a Lie group, simply vanishing of the curvature. You impose the vanishing of the curvature. Now you can construct the two BF theory where you basically, you know, pass from the two group to a differential cross module, which is simply a pair of corresponding Lie algebras with all these maps naturally induced. And then you also introduce a two connection, which is now you have the usual one form connection and the two form connection now appears. And these sort of you have sort of you have the now two kinds of transformations. You have sort of the usual gauge transformations, which transform the one form in the usual way, and then two form has a sort of this kind of transformation. And then there are these second gauge transformations associated with this H group, which transform the connection in this way, and this two form connection they transform in sort of this way. The only so there is this peculiar term which is quadratic. For a billion age groups, this term vanishes. So, but anyway, it's sort of internal case. So then you will have a curvature becomes a third curvature. That means you will have a pair of curvature. You have a two form and a three form. And you can basically define the so-called BFCG action, which is sort of the you just apply the Lagrange multipliers to a two curvature, so two curvature and the three curvature form. So this is gauge invariant, provided these Lagrange multipliers transform. They have the following gauge in transformations. So this is. Now the question is how would you apply this construction to general relativity? Okay, then you essentially this would be this BFCG, the topological part. So it's sort of direct application of this formula. Now you can recognize this C field is actually a tetrad. It has the same transformation as the usual tetrad. It's a one form. And then there is a constraint because you want to have a local degrees of freedom. You don't want to have a topological theory. And the constraint is just the what you expect to be, that B field is just the wedge product of two tetrads. So here you can write this in a simple way because you have tetrads. The one of the problems in spin forms that you didn't have tetrads, so this constraint you have to write a certain quadratic constraint in B fields, and then you have sort of you have the usual curvature, and then there is this extra new three curvature. Okay, this gives you the usual Einstein equations. And so the whole point of this reformulation is then to then repeat what was done in spin form models. First, let's try to construct the topological state sum, and then later see how to implement the constraint in order to get to general relativity. Okay, so the general categorical and pathological consideration implies that this this topological state sum should be of the following form. You would essentially you have to have labels for the edges, for the triangles, and for the tetrahedrons, and these labels are essentially two group labels which correspond to two group representation, to intertwiner and two intertwiner. This is the sort of the new object which appears because you're dealing with two groups. And now there has been work on representations of the Poincaré and Euclidean two group, which was done by Crane Shepard and then later by Bratton, Friedel, and Weiss, and they shown that actually there exists representations of Poincaré Euclidean two group, which are labeled by these positive numbers, which should play the role of lengths. And it turns out that if these intertwiners are the SO2 IRIPs, then these lengths satisfy the triangle inequality. So you can put them on the edges of a triangle. And the two intertwiners are trivial. So they.
That's a what's W3? Or are you going to define it?
Yeah, that's okay. I will tell you. I mean, yeah, it's some weight. Now, how it's going to? Okay, so this is sort of the general formula because of this simplification. So it gets like this. So you have one less label. So you have just two labels. Now the question is, what is it? Now, there's been a study by Baratin and Friedel where this W3 should be sort of this form. So it's a product of the areas of the triangles where area is given by the usual Heron formula. And then cosine of this S sigma, which looks like sort of area regi action. But they have these M labels, which are these SU2 divided by the volume. Now, it's sort of, it's not exactly that, because it's sort of, they have checked it only for some, not for all Pachner moves. So the answer is going to be more complicated than this. But it's a good indication to what one would expect to have it. And so guided by that, one can then try to implement this constraint simply by saying that these labels on triangles are basically proportional to the areas given by the Heron formula, because L's already satisfy the triangle inequalities. So then, so if you do this, then that cosine of S is going to be proportional to the regi action for this for simplex. So then a good candidate is simply to basically insert in this path in, so to define the following weights, where here I removed cosine, I just put e to the is. The reason is that it was mentioned by several people that as far as the, because later I will check this, the semi-classical limit by using effective action. And for the effective action, if you put here cosine, then it's not going to work. I mean, you're not going to get the right answer.
So you really mean a phase, not two phases?
Yeah, it's e to the is. You know, that's like what you do in usual cases. You know, what typically appears is like cosine of that's
cosine. You can also have a defect or something, right?
I know, but cosine is things gets difficult with the cosine. So since you're, but okay, I am just trying to arrange things such that I get something, which is useful. Now, there is this edge amplitude, which, OK, you can typically put to be, OK, L to some power R for large L. And then typically, now, there is another thing. You want, OK, since gravity is non-renormalizable, you want that the partition function is finite. That's what they do in string theory, for example. In order to avoid, you know, there is, so basically you can choose this R such that this whole expression gets finite. So then the question is, how are you going to solve that constraint? Okay, there are various possibilities. One is, you know, if you solve, you can solve these L's for the M's, because you know you have more triangles than the edge lengths. But you know, the usual problem is that you then, since you have more triangles than the edge lengths, you will have for the remaining ones, you will have a complicated Diophantine equation which you have to solve. So that this may not have or may have solutions, but may not have solutions. So it's something. So then, what you can do is relax. So one way to relax is to, for example, the remaining equations. You just take the integer part of the area. So this way, you sort of you avoid this problem of having to solve this Diophantine equation. It's sort of like. You know what, instead of similar to Gupta-Bleuler, you know, when you take like the expectation value of the constraint instead of the, so it's not like weakly. And then you can express everything in terms of these integers, which their number is same as the number of the edges. And you can get the corresponding state sum in the following form. So when you eliminate the delta function, you sort of get expression of this form, where you get the area sort of area Regge action of this form. But now you know that the that this will be the length Regge action because you have implemented the length constraint, because simply you solved all these, you know, these L's, they satisfy triangling inequalities. So you have solved, you know, these angles, these deficit angles, they correspond to area Regge with the constraints which give you the length. Now you can actually, what you can do, you can actually completely relax. You know what they did? They just relaxed the constraint that M is equal to the area. You can for only for these excess M's, but you can do it for all M's. You know, that's in that case, it's even easier to see that then you really get the Regge actually integer area Regge action. And this is, let's see. Because this can be trivially solved, you know. So you just take any L's, then you take the integer part, it will give you the integer. So then you sort of have a trivial solution. So this is actually really the another choice of the constraints which directly gives you. Okay, so it's not exactly Regge, but let's say integer Regge area, integer Regge length action. Okay, for large areas, this would be the Regge action. Okay, so now here this is this technique of the effective action, which is essentially defined by this integral differential equation, which is just simply copied from the quantum field theory textbooks. The only thing is that you have to look for complex solutions of this equation, and then you define your usual action as a sort of this real part plus imaginary part. This is the analog of the weak rotation, what you do in quantum field theory. Because of the short time, I cannot get it. So essentially, what you get that your effective action is the usual Regge action plus, okay, there is this measure term because I introduced it in order to make the partition function finite, and then you get this trace log term, which is exactly the discretization of the usual trace log term you get from quantum field theory. So. And then you can show that you get corrections of the order, which are 1 over L, where k equals 2 for S Regge and k equals 0 for this. But they are, you can show that they are, if you expand for large L's, this gamma, you can show that the subsequent terms are smaller order. So you do have that this is the leading term. So for large L, you have the classical limit is the Regge action. Then you have these quantum corrections, okay, which can be calculated. But that's and so so this is the example of a theory which. Okay, so can give you. Area Regge model or a length Regge model, depending on how the GR constraints is imposed. The effective action, the same classical version, can be easily calculated for the length Regge model. The other one is a little bit complicated, but can be done. In principle, it's not that difficult. Now, matter, you can couple matter directly because you have edge length, so you don't have a problem. You just write the usual discretized form of the matter amplitude. Okay, there are spin connection for fermions. You have to sort of correct the usual spin connection with this fermionic term. And okay, the things that you can now think which could be done is try to canonically quantize this two Poincaré general relativity action I wrote in the, I mean, what I presented here is sort of path integral quantization, but you can do canonical quantization, which I haven't done it because you have to, you know, the canonical analysis is not simple. So this is something I am working now. So basically, this canonical quantization can sort of give you a way to categorify the loop quantum gravity. I mean, what you sort of, the instead of spin networks, you would have spin forms. And the last thing for a mathematical inclined is that also this path integral construction may give you a way to construct four manifold invariants. But this is something which is more and more complicated. I will stop here.
Simone?
Just a quick question. In this Hessian that enters your quantum corrections, has he got any zero modes? Do you know?
Say it again.
Has he got any zero modes, the Hessian?
This Hessian. Yeah, this it's in principle, this is the without zero. I mean, there in principle should not be zero modes, you know, because it's completely gauge fixed. So should be, you shouldn't have it. Should be by definition has to be without zero modes removed. But that means you completely gauge fixed the theory.
Can I ask a naive question?
Yes.
Okay, naive question is it working? The naive question is, so what do we gain from this categorical approach? And what does it mean physically?
Yeah, the one thing is that you can have edge lengths beside the areas of triangles. I mean, that's sort of.
But you look at, you think of edge lengths or as some categorical area?
Yeah, it is. If you go to the dual complex, then you have you will have a three. Three. you want to answer?
Yeah, okay,
you have a three volume. So you give if you look in a dual graph. So instead of a two complex, you have a three complex.
Yeah, but, so
that's but I mean the original idea also with Aristide was that. Okay, first, you know, you start here, in some sense, the model we first proposed is was somehow a description of flat space. So there's a purely two categorical description of a four-dimensional flat space. In the same way that there's a purely categorical description of three-dimensional geometry, which is Ponzano energy.
Okay.
So then...
So you're lifting 3D to 4D.
3D to 4D. So then, in Ponzano energy, okay, you know, what happens there is that turning out the curvature amounts to some kind of algebraic operation, which is finding all possible deformations of one category, which are self-consistent. And then these are classified, these are the quantum groups, and voila. And then you realize, you know, if you think about let's say, from this perspective, somehow a space-time is, you probe it by particles, so somehow a space-time is just a way to measure interaction. So having a deformation and gravity.
But you don't imagine you get some type of one-dimensional objects.
Yeah, there would be some one-dimensional objects. So the idea is that, you know, you can think of gravity as some kind of deformation of the way particles move. Okay. So then you're looking for a categorical description where you're looking for all possible deformation. So the idea was, okay, let's first go to, and it's also, you know, originally related to the idea of Crane. Let's go to a categorical description of four-dimensional. Is there a deformation?
Okay.
Quantum gravity should be a deformation.
Okay, so you said voila at some point. I think
We had a nice session this afternoon, and if we don't go downstairs right now, there will be no food left. So thank you very much.